progress will always come from Demos, from we the people.
Greece has made a tremendous comeback. We've worked with them very closely.
The United States recognizes only one legitimate government of the Republic of Cyprus.
Nothing can break the spirit of the Greek people.
Long live the friendship between Greece and the United States of America. Ευχαριστώ. Thank you very much.
I'm Thanos Davelis, and this is The Greek Current. Last week, we got a look at the details of President Trump's 28-point plan for an end to the war in Ukraine, with the president setting a Thursday deadline for Ukraine, where many see the proposed plan as a capitulation to agree to it. U.S. and Ukrainian officials met on Sunday in Geneva, with the White House hailing talks as constructive. Paul Stairs, the director of the Center for Preventive Action and coordinator for the Special Initiative on Securing Ukraine's Future at the Council on Foreign Relations, joins me as we look into this plan and what it means for Ukraine, Europe, and NATO. Paul, thanks for joining us on The Greek Current.
Very nice to join you tonight.
We're speaking on Friday as reports broke with details of President Trump's peace plan for Ukraine. Ukraine's President Zelensky has said that any deal must bring a dignified peace. In your view, does this leaked peace plan do this?
Well, I found the 28-point plan to be deeply flawed document, one that is highly biased toward Russia's interests. As a professional diplomatic document, it is also deeply flawed. I find it frankly embarrassing that we would present such a incomplete, well, ill-conceived document to any foreign country, frankly, and on such an important issue, too. There are so many areas of the document that are ambiguous or, frankly, alarming in their consequences for Ukraine's security and Europe's security.
You mentioned how many of the points are biased towards Russia. How so?
Well, in terms of territorial concessions, you know, conceding on the question that Ukraine would have to reduce its armed forces, very loose talk about non-aggression agreements, which we know from previous commitments of this kind, Russia has essentially not observed in the past, that we are just accepting or would accept their word on this, is frankly astounding in my view. So, and the notion of compensation, that the United States would get some interest payment for brokering this deal, it's embarrassing. I'm frankly embarrassed that we would even discuss an outcome for the Ukraine war in these terms.
As you mentioned, many of the White House ideas we've seen in these reports are at odds with longstanding Ukrainian and European positions. What's at stake for both? And by extension, what could this mean for NATO?
Well, Ukraine's security is, and the outcome of this war is vital to Europe's long-term security. If Russia is allowed to essentially subjugate Ukraine and more or less be rewarded for territorial aggression, you know, a core part of the post-Second World War international order, that casts enormous consequences for NATO's security. And you will see Russian forces move closer to NATO's eastern border. You could see the possibility that Russia will be much more emboldened now in terms of carrying out provocations against NATO members. I think the objective of the recent provocations with drones and aircraft has been to test NATO's willingness to really stand by this ironclad Article 5 security commitment to any member, and particularly the U.S. commitment to Europe's security. And it's all part of an effort to weaken the U.S. resolve in maintaining that commitment, which has kept the peace for 70, 80 years in Europe. And this has been a long-term goal of President Putin. And so if we are to concede here to Russian demands and accept the end of the war on these terms, I think it has profound consequences for European security, including Greece's.
And European capitals seem to register this, and they're rushing to coordinate a response to this peace plan as we speak. But is the EU in a position to put an alternative on the table or to influence Washington on this matter?
Well, you're right. European leaders, particularly the E3, led by Chancellor Merz, coordinated a response earlier today to show their, I think the term was, unwavering support for Ukraine's security and their willingness to support Ukraine in any kind of negotiation with Washington. And we've seen this in the past. They're like the proverbial fire brigade that has to be called every few weeks to come to Ukraine's aid and try to convince President Trump that the course that he's on is deeply flawed and deeply concerning to Europe. At some point, he may brush aside those concerns. He, as press reports suggest, is demanding that Ukraine more or less accept these terms by Thanksgiving Day. That's next Thursday for non-Americans. That's just incredible that a country is being asked to, frankly, pressured to make huge concessions in a matter of days. It's unacceptable. And Western Europe is rightly pushing back on that. And I expect the EU, in addition to NATO leaders, will do the same. Hopefully, they're on calling the White House as we speak, making clear their objections to what has been negotiated here.
Well, what does all of this tell us about President Trump's worldview? Because I'm sure other adversaries are watching closely, and China is the first that comes to mind. And they're looking to see what the White House is willing to put on the table here and how Trump wants to deal with Putin on this.
Absolutely. Well, I think if you connect the dots over what President Trump has said on a variety of instances, he clearly questions long-term U.S. support for Europe. It's really unclear that he understands the importance of these ironclad Article 5 commitments. This latest 28-point plan talks about U.S. security guarantees to Ukraine. On the surface, that seems encouraging, that the U.S. would be prepared to do that. But when you sort of scratch the surface, you have to question whether President Trump truly believes that he is extending Article 5 commitments to Ukraine. Some of your listeners may recall that something similar was offered to Qatar following the Israeli attack on Doha. But this worded commitment that was issued afterwards has no legal standing. It is not a treaty that the Senate ratifies. And therefore, it's pretty much worthless. If I were in Kyiv, I certainly wouldn't put much by that. And so, other countries, you mentioned China, but elsewhere, they see this. They see where the U.S. is going. And they may feel that when the time is ripe, they can exploit the U.S. lack of resolve in supporting allies and being truly principled in the way it acts. And that's deeply worrying to many, many of us in the United States and in Europe.
Back in August, you wrote a piece for the Council on Foreign Relations where you looked at how a ceasefire agreement could bolster both Ukraine's security and NATO's. What are some things, maybe the top two or three, that you think could lead to a more secure Ukraine and NATO today? And how would you sell it to the Trump administration in a way that speaks to their worldview?
So in the piece you cite, I acknowledge that the likelihood of Ukraine becoming a member of NATO is remote, even though we've made that commitment. And I think as part of a settlement, we would probably have to say that was now off the table and deferred indefinitely for the future. It's possible that some European countries might offer security guarantees or boots on the ground in Ukraine, but it's unlikely. So ultimately, the future security of Ukraine will be in Ukraine's hands, and that requires that there be no restrictions on Ukraine's security forces, its ability to defend itself, to deter potential aggression. What would really make a difference, however, is if the terms of the ceasefire also included very robust provisions to create a strong line of contact or line of control between Russia and Ukraine so that it would be extremely costly for Russia to contemplate violating any kind of ceasefire. And here I mean, you know, extensive minefields and fortifications, a reserve force, international monitors, a very robust armistice arrangement that would not be easy for Russia to essentially violate. And it would provide the time for Ukraine to mobilize its forces in response. And only with this kind of careful preparation for a ceasefire, I think, will Ukraine have any kind of confidence that a peace deal will stick. And that really was the purpose of the paper I wrote, that we should be really focusing as much on the details of the ceasefire than these very general ideas about, you know, land swaps and so on. So that's really the core of the argument.
Paul, it's been great chatting. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again. Pleasure to be with you.
Taking us to our headlines for the day, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said on Monday that Greece's latest energy initiatives will significantly enhance its geopolitical standing as the country takes on a larger role in US-backed efforts to reshape Europe's gas supply. Greece last week became the first EU country to actively participate in Washington's plan to replace Russian gas with American LNG. Mitsotakis said the agreement marks Greece's shift from being a peripheral player in energy matters to becoming a leading actor. Finally, the Associated Press reports there has been a surge of renewed optimism ahead of Pope Leo's visit to Turkey over the possible reopening of Halki Theological Seminary, which Turkey closed in 1971. Archbishop Elpidophoros, head of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America, told the Associated Press that a committee of representatives from the Ecumenical Patriarchate and the Turkish government has begun discussions on the reopening. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.